Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are live for a half hour for some and for an hour for others. Each weekday afternoon, we actually have an hour-long program. Some of the stations carry only a half hour. Actually, some stations carry the first half hour and some carry the second half hour, interestingly enough. But most of our stations carry the whole hour, and that's what we have ahead of us. And if you are listening to a station that only carries a half hour, you know, you can hear the whole program from our website, thenarrowpath.com, which streams it live and archives the programs for later listening if you can't listen live. Or you can get the apps for your iPhone or your Android for thenarrowpath.com, and you can listen to the program live or later there. There's also the podcast available to sign up for. So there's all kinds of ways to hear the whole program, although many of you will only hear half the program on your radio station. The purpose of the program being live is that we can actually talk back and forth. In many kinds of radio broadcasts, there's just a recorded person giving a sermon to the listeners, and that's fine if it's a good sermon. But sometimes you wish you could ask some questions about it or maybe even state some disagreements to what you hear. In this program, you can do just that. And if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith or any disagreements with this host, you can call. And that's what we're here for, each weekday for an hour a day. And the number to call if you'd like to be on the program today, because we do have a couple of lines open right now, is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Ken, calling from Santa Fe Springs, California. Ken, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, thanks for taking my call. My question is about Revelation 13, verses 15 through 18. I'm going to ask my question, and I'm going to have to listen offline because I got to get back to work. So in Revelation 13 and 15, it's talking about the beast. What's going on? Is the beast a real person? Is it a system? Did this already take place? Is it something that we're looking forward to? I'm confused, and thank you for taking my question.
All right, well, thank you for calling. Well, whenever we ask questions about Revelation, you have to realize we have to be prepared for a lot of different opinions that people have about Revelation. It's the most controversial book in the Bible. And one of the things that causes problems with it is that people don't agree as to the extent to which we're to take it literally or figuratively, symbolically. I take most of the book symbolically, and that is because it is a book made up of symbolic visions. At least I say they're symbolic. Now, anyone who wants to say they're not symbolic really might do us all a favor by explaining how one can take all these things literally. The beast himself in this chapter is an animal with a mouth of a lion, feet of a bear, a body like a leopard, seven heads and ten horns, and the whole world worships the beast, and he rules the world. And an image is made of the beast, and everyone's told to worship the image, and there's a number given to everyone on their hand or their forehead, without which they can't buy or sell. Now, how much of that do you want to take literally? You know, first of all, I don't know anyone who takes it literally, because no one believes that there is or will ever be or ever was such an animal. Yes, if you're taking it literally, you're talking about an animal here. That's what it is. It's a beast. The word beast means animal. It doesn't mean a human being. And so if you're saying, well, the beast is really a human being, then what you're saying is it's symbolic. You're saying that the beast represents a human being and that it might, in fact, do so. I will not deny, because the things in Revelation do represent things. That means they're symbolic. They're not literal. If it was talking about a human being and speaking literally, it would say a man, because that's what would literally be true. Calling it a beast with seven heads and ten horns. Then we're later told in chapter 17 that the seven heads are seven mountains. And the ten horns are ten kings. Okay, we're clearly not talking about an individual man, even if it's symbolic. It is symbolic because it certainly is not talking about a literal animal. Nobody believes an animal is going to rule the world. But many people believe it's a man, although that's a strange position to take. Although popular, it's still strange because, again, the beast has seven heads. Each of them represents a mountain. Does a man represent seven mountains? Are there parts of a man that represent seven mountains? And the ten horns are ten kings. So, and that's part organically part of the beast. So a man who is or parts of his body are 10 kings would not be very reasonable. Now, what we do know is that the beast described in Revelation 13 bears a great resemblance, at least in a combination of images borrowed from Daniel's chapter 7, four beasts. Daniel saw four beasts like this one. They came out of the sea. If you read Daniel chapter 7, he had a vision. Out of the sea, there emerged four beasts in sequence, a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a beast with 10 horns. John also sees a beast arising out of the sea. It's got features of all four of Daniel's beasts because it has the mouth of a lion. A lion was Daniel's first beast. It's got the feet of a bear. That was Daniel's second beast. It's got the body of a leopard. That was Daniel's third beast. And it's got 10 horns, as did Daniel's fourth beast. So this creature, this image, incorporates four different beasts that are found in Daniel. Now, what's that supposed to mean? Well, one thing we know is that the beasts in Daniel did not represent human beings. So there's not very much likelihood that the beast in Revelation does either. Why would it? It's clear that the beasts in Daniel represented the Babylonian Empire and successor empires. Most people think the Media-Persian and the Greek and the Roman Empire. Some think the Medes, Persians, and Greeks are the three following empires. We won't discuss that right now. The point is there are four empires, each of them represented by one beast. Now, if there's already a precedent in Scripture for identifying a beast as an empire, and there certainly is in Daniel, then why would we break that precedent and say the beast in Revelation, which has some of the same features, is not an empire? It's not a system. It's a man. Well, I don't agree that it is a man. As a matter of fact, I don't believe it's one empire. The fact that all four of Daniel's beasts are mixed up into one suggests that this represents perhaps all empires, all four of Daniel's, and perhaps others besides. That is going to be my starting point. It's the most reasonable way to see how the imagery in Revelation is meant to be explained by the imagery in Daniel, which you have to compare the two to make some sense of it. All right, so you've got a beast that represents political systems, I believe. I'm going to suggest it represents all political systems which turn against Christianity. Not all political systems do, but many of them do. And you'll recognize the beast here has seven heads and 10 horns. In the previous chapter, Revelation 12, the dragon, who clearly represents Satan, also has seven heads and 10 horns. If you read about the dragon in the opening verses of Revelation 12, it says the dragon had seven heads and 10 horns. He's also said to be a red dragon. Well, this beast in Revelation 13, we're not told that he's red here, but we see the same beast in chapter 17, and he's said to be scarlet or red. So it's clear that the dragon, which is Satan, seems to be clothed in this costume of a beast. It's got the same number of heads, same number of horns, same color, but it's a political manifestation. Satan is not a political person. He is a spirit, but he can clothe himself in political systems, and he has done so many times. He clothed himself in the Babylonian system, which persecuted people like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He clothed himself in the Media-Persian and the Greek and the Roman empires, each of which in their own way, did some harm to God's people, although the Media-Persian empire did probably more good than harm. But the Greeks and the Romans, you'll find persecution of Jews, at least, and certainly by the Romans, persecution of Christians. So this is, I think, depicting Satan in his political manifestations. The beast represents that. Now, which manifestation? Well, many. Obviously, all four of Daniel's beasts are mixed into this one, and I'm going to suggest that the imagery suggests any political system that Satan uses to embody his war against Christianity. You see, in the verse before the beginning of chapter 13, the last verse in chapter 12, it says, the dragon was angry with the woman and went to make war against her and the remnant of her seed who have the testimony of Jesus and keep the commandments of God. So these are the Christians. And the dragon is making war with them. And then the next verse says that he calls this beast out of the sea to come and obviously persecute the saints. So Satan is waging an ongoing war against Christianity, against Christ and his people. And one of the allies he uses is any political system that will allow him to embed himself in it and pursue his agenda through it. And therefore, I think the beast represents a concept, not one particular system in history or in the future, but in any time, from the Babylonian or even before that, the Egyptian and the Assyrian, certainly the Babylonian, the Roman, and many other empires, including modern-day communism and modern-day fascism and modern-day Islamic states that persecute Christians. Any political system that is making war against the saints is seen as an embodiment of Satan's power and agenda manifest in a political system. That's what I think the beast refers to, and I think the beast refers to all time, all politics, all political systems of all time. All right, that's what I believe. Now, the second beast he sees comes out of the land, and it has religious tendencies. It has horns like a lamb, which it reminds us of Jesus, who's considered to be a lamb in Revelation. It has it speaks like a serpent or like a dragon. So it's like a wolf in sheep's clothing, so to speak. As Jesus said, false prophets, they come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravening wolves. Like a beast that has horns like a lamb is obviously in some respects a mimicry of Christ. Comes like a sheep, but on the other hand, it speaks like a dragon, showing what is inside of it. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So this is like a fake Christianity, or maybe just fake religion in general, counterfeit religion. Now, if the first beast represented satanically inspired political systems, I'm going to suggest the second beast represents satanically inspired false religious systems, which are in league with those political systems. Almost all political systems have some kind of religious ideology that they support. Even communism, which calls itself atheist, that's their religion. Certainly atheism is a religion just as much as any other. And so any false religion that's in league with any false political or demonic political system is an ally of Satan and becomes part of the tools by which Satan makes war against the saints. And that is what's being said here, and I believe it, I think it applies to the entire history of the church. Satan has these allies, and the church has faced persecution and heresy as the main opposition to it ever since Jesus was here. And I think that's what John is depicting in this vision, or what God is depicting in the vision in John's recording. Now, that doesn't mean that the beast would not be manifested in any given time or place as either one political system or one political person. The mark of the beast is the number of a man's name, and the number is 666. In my opinion, I have reasons for it, which you can find if you want to read my book about Revelation 4 views, but I'll just assume you'll take my word for it that I have very good reasons for whatever I'm thinking about this. I believe that 666 is the number of an individual man. But he's not the whole beast. He is the beast to the readers. The readers of Revelation originally were in the Roman Empire. They were in the part of Roman Empire called Asia Minor, but they were under the emperor. And I believe the emperor at the time of the writing of this of these epistles, of the Revelation, the emperor was Nero, I believe. Now, many people think it was Domitian. I'm not going to get into that controversy right now. I have to get down to what you asked me. We have to lay all this groundwork first, because what you asked me rests upon a foundation. The answer does. So I believe that Nero was the local present manifestation of this beast in the time of John. And I think the number 666 refers to Caesar Nero. The numbers of his name in Hebrew, if you change Caesar Nero into Hebrew characters, does come out to 666. Now, the justification for taking that approach, I won't go into right now, but there are, again, my book will cover all that if you're interested. So I believe that the beast in general represents any political power that Satan uses to persecute the church, and in particular, in the days of John's readers, the manifestation that was in their neighborhood and at their time was Caesar Nero himself, who persecuted the church. Now, what does it mean to take the mark of the beast? Now, it says if a person does not take the mark of the beast, that they will not be able to buy or sell. Based on this statement, it is very common for popular prophecy teachers to say that there's going to be like a credit number or an identification number or a chip of some kind put under the skin on the hand or the forehead of some future generation, and it will replace money as a means of buying things. For this reason, some say that the Bible teaches there will be a cashless society. It certainly does not teach that anywhere. There's no reference in the Bible to a cashless society, but it's a deduction that some have reached when they assume there's a future Antichrist who's going to replace cash with this number on the hand or the forehead, and it will be used in place of cash for purchasing. It'll be like a credit number, sort of like your debit card would be now, only it'll be printed on you. Now, okay, let me just say this. I don't see any reason to believe that this is referring to a cashless society. I don't think John's readers ever faced a cashless society, but they were certainly facing the beast, because he said that his readers, and they lived in the first century after all, he said that if they were wise, they could figure out who the beast was by name from the number he gave. He says, he that is wise among you, let him calculate the number of the beast. It's the number of a man. His number is 666. It's clear John thinks that any wise reader of his day in the first century could identify the beast from that number. And I think they could. And therefore, the beast must have been a person who is currently on the scene and who fit the descriptions of the beast that Revelation gives. And I believe that that would be Nero. I think they would have understood that to be Nero in all likelihood, or the Roman Empire at least. Now, that being so, in what sense would the Roman Empire have instituted a cashless society? Well, they didn't. But the Bible doesn't say they will. It says that those who don't take the mark will not be able to buy or sell. Well, does that mean they won't have cash? No. It could mean that whether they have cash or not, they still won't be able to buy or sell because people won't interact with them economically. This is not uncommon in history for Christians or even not just Christians, but Jews. For example, in Nazi Germany, people didn't like them, and therefore they decided not to do business with them. And you know, because you don't conform. If you're Jewish in Germany in the time of the Holocaust, of course, there's other reasons. But Christians have been hated like that in many parts of the world, and in all parts of the world at some time or another, and have found that people would boycott them. It's a form of persecution. It has nothing to do with whether you have cash or not. You could have all the cash in the world, but if people are saying, we are not going to do business with you, you won't be able to buy or sell. And that's what I think is being referred to here. I think it's referring to persecution in general, with economic persecution and boycott being given as a sample. Just like when Revelation talks about martyrdom of Christians in general, it always refers to them as being beheaded. And yet not all Christians were beheaded who were martyred. A lot of them were crucified or burned at the stake or otherwise. But one form of martyrdom stands as a symbol or representative of all forms of martyrdom. So all martyrs are described as being beheaded. Likewise, economic persecution, it's not quite lethal, but it is persecution and painful and very inconvenient. And I think it just stands for persecution in general. That's what I believe. Now, what is the mark then? The mark, I believe, is an imagery taken from the Roman custom of tattooing slaves with the brand of their master. It could be his name, his initials, a number. It could be a logo, a brand, like we have on cattle. But they would tattoo on the slave's forehead or hand the owner's emblem. And that would show that they were his slaves. Now, it would show it very obviously, because when you see someone coming, you can almost always see, no matter what he's wearing, you can almost always see his forehead or his hand. Those are the parts of the body not very often covered with clothing. And therefore, it was hard for someone to conceal whose slave he was if he had these tattoos on him, these brands. Now, notice in Revelation 14, the very next verse after the mark of the beast, in Revelation 14:1, it says that God's people have their father's name written on their foreheads. So we have a very clear contrast here between people who have God's name on their foreheads and those who have the name of Satan's system on their foreheads. Now, I don't think Christians have literally God's name written on their foreheads. We don't have that. We don't write things on our foreheads necessarily. But it's what it's saying, of course, in language that a Roman citizen would certainly understand, that someone who had a name written on their forehead, it would be their master's name. And it would mean that these people are quite self-evidently the servants of the person whose name is on their forehead. And Christians are the servants of God and have, as it were, his name on their forehead. He's their master. And it's advertised easily. Anyone who looks at them should be able to tell that they're his, because Christians behave and think differently than other people. But most people would have the number of the beast or of Satan's system on their forehead. And that would be obvious by looking at them, too. They're servants of Satan, and their actions and their words and their thoughts give them away. So I believe the mark of the beast is simply a reference to the fact that certain people are slaves of Satan and other people are slaves of God. And both have, as it were, their father's or their master's name on their forehead in Revelation. But that no one has a real name written on their forehead. This is a figure of speech which, as I said, appealing to the custom of branding slaves in that manner, would suggest that these people, everyone is either a slave of Satan or a slave of God. And you can tell by looking at their hands, which represent their works, or their foreheads, which represent their thoughts. You can see that Christians think and behave and do different works than Satan's servants do. And what I believe it's saying about not being able to buy or sell is that Christians have always found that heathen object to our ways of thinking and actions. Our works and our thoughts are contrary to theirs. And this has been the cause of persecution of Christians from the very beginning. And throughout church history, Christians have known persecution of various kinds because of the stand they take as servants of God rather than servants of Satan. And that is what I believe the whole Mark of the Beast thing is about. Now, you might say, Steve, why'd you take a whole half hour almost talking about this one question? The reason is that's the only call we had. We don't have any other calls waiting. So if you want to be on the program, you can call 844-484-5737. You can call with a disagreement. And I know many of you listening out there disagree. So why don't you call? Or you can call with another question on another subject if you'd like. But you have to call or else I'll just have to talk. And I can talk for a long time about just about anything. But I would rather talk to you about what's on your mind. And you let me know by giving me a call and asking. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And I want to say to our Southern California listeners, because we have some listening, that every Thursday morning, that's tomorrow morning, I have a Bible study I'm teaching in the life and teachings of Christ, going through the four Gospels, harmonizing the four Gospels, and it's held at Panera Bread in Temecula. It may not be very near where you live, but we have someone who drives from L.A. to get there, and that's an hour and a half. We have some who come from Riverside. That's an hour. So, I mean, there's people who drive some distance to come to it. It's at 6:30 every Thursday morning at Panera Bread in Temecula. And if you want to come to that, we'd be glad to have you. That obviously is only applicable to Southern California listeners, because I don't expect people in Seattle or Portland or elsewhere to catch a plane down for that early in the morning. Though I will say this, I used to teach a weekly Bible study in Santa Cruz, and we had a couple of guys fly down from Portland just for the Bible study. So I never know who may show up or from where. But for those of you in Southern California, at least, every Thursday morning, 6:30, Panera Bread, teaching in the life and teachings of Christ. I hope you may want to join us, because it's a good group that comes, and we have a good in-depth study. All right, we're going to talk to, we have another caller, but we also have coming up here a break, because some of our stations are leaving the network. They only take a half hour of the program, but we go on for another half hour. Those of you whose stations are leaving, I'd recommend, if you'd like to hear the second half hour, get the app for your phone, and you can listen to the whole program, or just get on your computer if you're near it, and go to thenarrowpath.com. And once you're there, go to the radio tab, and then hit the listen now, and you'll be able to hear the whole program, whether your local station carries it or not. Okay, and I just need to, let me just begin this call. It looks like it's Mika, unless it's Micah, from Seattle. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. No, it's Micah.
Micah, okay. Yeah, the last letter of your name was left off by the call screen. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Anyway, quick question, and I'll take it off the air. Basically, I was just calling to see what you thought. You know the book, As a Man Thinketh, by James Allen?
No.
Oh, okay. I think it's a secular book, more or less, but a lot of Christians use it due to it's all about positive affirmations, the way to be positive makes your reality in life. I was more or less curious what you thought about this and if it was very biblical or not.
Well, Micah, I'm afraid I don't know that book. If I did, I'd love to tell you what I think about it, but I'm not familiar with it. If you want to stay on through this 30-second break, I'll put you back on the air and you can tell me something about its contents so we can discuss it. I do need to break for 30 seconds and allow our listeners who are leaving the network to do so in a dignified manner. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener-supported. I hope you go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, to use everything that's there, which is everything's free. Or you can donate to help us stay on the air if you'd like at thenarrowpath.com. And if you haven't been to the website, you'll be amazed. There's a lot more there than this radio program. A lot of free stuff. Please stay tuned for 30 seconds, and we'll be back.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
All right, as promised, I am back. And for those of the stations who are just picking up this second half of the program, you're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and our phone lines are open for you if you'd like to call and ask questions about the Bible or raise points of disagreement with the host. Welcome. Please do so. The number to call is 844-484-5737. You may find the lines busy if you call now, but they will be opening up again, and you can get through before the show is finished, I'm sure, if you keep this number on hand. 844-484-5737. And Micah, whom we were talking to before the break, did not stay on line to talk further. So I invited him to, but that's okay. Perhaps it said all he wanted to say. Let's talk to Michael from Rockland, California. Michael, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Steve. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, thank you for your program. It's wonderful. Hey, I have a question for you on Genesis 1. You know, I don't know where your position is on, you know, the six-day, 24-hour day creation or not.
Uh-huh.
But I'm wondering if that is your position. I know it's a lot of folks' position. Where, how you reconcile the sun and the moon being created on the fourth day.
Okay. Well, first of all, I do lean toward the literal six-day creation young earth model, though I am not as wedded to it as some people are, because I'm open to whatever the truth may be. And the Bible doesn't always speak in literal terms, although it does seem to me that Genesis 1 does. In my opinion, Genesis 1 is telling the story of creation literally. If I am mistaken, then I'd be glad to be corrected by, you know, evidence, and it's not a hard-nosed position I'm in. The thing is, from what I've heard of evidences for old Earth and for young Earth, including arguments from people who are, you know, scientists and astronomers and things like that on both sides, and also from what the Bible itself seems to say and the best way I lean toward the literal translation. I always have. I'll just say that's always been my default position on everything, really, almost in the Bible. When I change my position, it's usually because of overwhelming evidence that just kind of knocks me over and makes me change my position. And I'm willing to do that. I've done it on many things. I would do it on this if it were if the evidence seemed to make it necessary. But coming from the young earth view, you're asking what would justify a belief that the fourth day was the introduction of the sun and the moon and the stars. if the earth was created on the first day and there was light and darkness, day and night, on the first day, and there was even plant growth on the earth on the third day, and yet the sun, moon, stars didn't even exist until the fourth day. This sounds pretty crazy, especially to people who already are doubting, you know, whether the Bible's reliable about these things. Well, since I don't bring, you know, doubts unnecessarily to passages, I mean, I will doubt things that seem impossible, but I don't have a real problem with God doing this in 6 days, and I don't have a problem with him providing light from some source other than the sun, moon, and stars for the first 3 days. In fact, I think it's very brilliant, because certainly in Moses' day when this was written, it was well known that the sun is the source of light during the daytime, and the moon is the main light during the night. In fact, when it talks about this on the fourth day, it specifically says that. And therefore, if someone was making this up, if it was just mythology and something they're making up, they would certainly have put the sun and the moon and the stars first before they start having the succession of day and night. It's not as if ancient Hebrews were less intelligent than we are. In many respects, I think they're a lot more intelligent than a lot of people I meet. But the point is, they would know the same problem that you're bringing up. So why is the sun, moon, and stars mentioned as being created the fourth day? Well, as I said, it's because it's true, I think. If it was not true, they would make it a different way. They would do the story differently. Certainly, even ancient people knew that plants grow from the benefit of sunlight and die without it. And yet you have plants growing and so forth on the third day, and then the sun coming. So we have to argue that either this is the way it happened, or, you know, people were making up a myth that didn't make sense even with reference to their current knowledge about things. And that's not usually what I would expect to happen. So let's start with the idea that perhaps it's true. Perhaps there was light and darkness, not from the sun, moon, and stars, certainly, but from another source. But later on, the job of bringing light to the world was delegated to the sun and the moon and the stars on the fourth day. Why? If God's going to make day and night from the beginning, why not make sun, moon, and stars from the beginning? It's very clear that in the fourth day it says he made the greater light, by which I think he means the sun, to rule the day, and the lesser light, meaning the moon, to rule the night. So, I mean, the writer is very clear that the day is dominated by sunlight and the night by moonlight. He knew that, so why didn't he put it in the first day? Because he couldn't. If he was making it up, he would have, but he wasn't making it up. It was obviously something in the story, something about his sources, constrained him to do that which would have seemed as counterintuitive to him as it does to us. But why? I think I may know an answer, or at least I can suggest a possible answer. I can't claim to know for certain. But I believe that the reason God did not make the sun, moon, and stars as early as he wanted there to be light and darkness, but waited a bit until there was already living things, plants, before he made them, is it would take away any possibility of suggesting that the sun is the source of life or light, really. God is the source of life and light, and both of them exist on the world before the sun was created. And then the sun was delegated the role of continuing to provide light and life to the plant world and so forth. So that God deliberately provided the light and the life without the sun, so that people would not make the mistake that all the great wrong religions did make, thinking the sun was the great God and the source of life. I mean, the Egyptians, where Moses grew up, by the way, among the Egyptians, he was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, it says in Acts chapter 7. The Egyptians taught that the sun was the greatest god, Ra, and it was the great deity and the source of life. And all pagan right. religions, all pagan religions believe that. Moses obviously didn't. And when he wrote this, he made it very clear. Ra, the sun, didn't come along until quite a bit later. There were already plants growing, already day and night being measured for 3 days before that. And what it does is shows that the source of life is God, not the sun. And that would be a huge point of difference between what Genesis teaches and what all the pagan religions taught about the sun God. Now, I would point this out also in the book of Revelation. when it talks about the New Jerusalem, it says the city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it because the glory of God was the light of it. In other words, the Bible acknowledges that there can be light without the sun, moon, and stars. The glory of God himself can provide the light. And so I suspect, again, I can't speak for God on points that he has not spoken for himself, but my guess is that he provided the light from his own face, from his own glory, initially because it is he, not the sun, that is the source of light and life, and therefore he delayed the sun.
I like your hypothesis. You added some dimension to my already thoughts on it. A couple of things that I might interject and just for thought and for ponder is, you know, I can't remember exactly where it's at. It's a little later in Genesis. Actually, I think he's summing it up, and he says, in the day that the Lord God created the heavens and the earth.
Yeah, that's Genesis 2:4, yeah.
Yeah, which is curious to me. I mean, I'm like you. I mean, I think I don't have a solid answer for it all, and I really see that. I mean, my vision of it is just like yours. It was the light of God in the beginning. Uh-huh. You know, the Spirit. God said, "Let there be light," and as the Spirit hovered over the face of the earth. But it also says somewhere right in that same context that the plants had not yet grown, and the water had not come up from the earth.
Yeah, that's in the second account of creation, right? Uh huh. Yeah, there's two accounts.
It just gives me a little thought for the possible. I mean, because the sun, the moon, he already says it. He says, "I give you that for signs and times and seasons."
Yeah.
And of course, as we know, that's how we get a day: is the Earth rotating on its axis 24 hours and then 365 a year, and so forth.
Right. Right.
And so that, you know, it seems like there's an inkling of some spiritual revelation there. And then one last thing, if I might just interject, and again, just for food for thought, is when Paul brings it up, I believe it's in 2 Corinthians, he parallels.
Chapter 4, verse 6. Yeah.
Yeah, he says, as God commanded the light to shine out of darkness, shine in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God.
Yes, I see a very clear parallel there. Yeah, I think that what Paul is suggesting is that the creation story in Genesis 1, in addition to being the way God really did things, is also God did it that way in order to prefigure spiritual parallels, that we were formless and void before we were Christians. God created us, but darkness was upon the face of the deep, upon our hearts, and we were unshapen. And void, empty, fruitless, until God began to speak and say, "Let there be light." And Paul says, as you pointed out in 2 Corinthians 6:4, he says, God, who called the light to shine out of darkness, he means in Genesis 1, has now shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So he's saying that there's a parallel between God bringing light in creation originally and us as a new creation. It's also in 2 Corinthians that Paul says, if any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. And so there's a spiritual recreation. And you know, in the story of Genesis 1, God started out with nothing. Or at least when he created the heavens and earth, it was in darkness and unshapen and unfruitful. But by stages, his word brought about transformation, just like his word does in our lives. As the Spirit hovered over the face of the waters, the working of the Holy Spirit and God's word in our lives transforms us. But into what? What was there at the end after the sixth day? And when he looked and said it was very good, he had made a man and a woman in his own image. That's what he was aiming at. He started with darkness and void and shapelessness, and he ended up with humans in his own image. And that's what he's doing in the new covenant. He causes the light to shine our hearts. He works in our hearts. He brings fruitfulness. He brings life. He brings order. He does this through the working of his word and the Spirit. And at the end, what he has in mind for us is he will have in us a man or a woman made in his own image. We're being changed from glory to glory into that same image, even as by the Spirit of the Lord, it says in 2 Corinthians 3:18. Notice how many of those verses are in 2 Corinthians. Anyway, I appreciate your call, Michael. My lines are full and I'm running out of time. So thank you for joining us.
God bless. Thank you.
God bless you, too. All right. Serge from Sacramento, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, you're going to have to speak, then I'll be able to hear you. I can hear you, yes.
Oh, okay. So I was listening to a couple of your sermons online, or your lectures, and you have some interesting takes on Christianity and mental illness. I was just wondering what your take is on, for instance, if there's a believer, a true believer, who's suffering from, let's say, depression or, you know, debilitating anxiety to the point where it's affecting their daily life.
Yeah.
What kind of advice would you have for them, or what's the biblical kind of take on?
Yeah. Well, let me just say, let me say first of all that when it comes to giving counsel about something that is commonly regarded to be in the realm of mental health, it'd be very dangerous for me to give any kind of definitive counsel in a situation where I can only speak for a few minutes to a person whose condition I don't really even know. In other words, if I were counseling a person who's going through depression, I would interview that person to find out what I can find out about their life. I'd like to know what medical tests they've had done, see if there's any kind of physiological cause for them to feel depressed, interview them about their life, see what's going on in their life, see what's going on in their spiritual life. This would be very time-consuming for me to do before I would even begin to suggest an answer. What I can say in general, but I don't mean this as counsel to you or any particular individual, what I can say in general as what I believe to be true is that many conditions, which are in fact spiritual conditions, have been mislabeled as mental health conditions. And that could include many cases of anxiety, many cases of depression, and so forth. But I would not include every case because there can be physiological causes of depression and anxiety. I don't consider them to be psychiatric illnesses. If a person has depression or anxiety or something like that, there can be physiological factors that are not psychiatric, but medical. You know, a thyroid imbalance, hypoglycemia, sleep deprivation. There can be chemical imbalances and so forth. It can be, hormonal. There's lots of different physiological things which are not in themselves psychiatric problems. They don't have names like schizophrenia or anything like that. They have names like thyroid problem or hypoglycemia, which actually have to do with measurable chemical imbalances which can be redressed medically. And that would be the first thing I'd want to look at. But I'd also want to look at spiritual things because I believe that many people who are depressed or anxious or have these other issues that they see psychiatrists for don't have a physiological problem, but it's a spiritual problem. Now, what kind of spiritual problem? Every time I say this on the air, I get in trouble with people. I don't care. It's a fact. Some people have demons, but not many, perhaps, of the people who are really in trouble have demons. There are plenty of troubles besides those that are caused by demons. But demonic possession is a reality, and some people need to consider whether that's the problem. Other people, they have a spiritual problem, but it's not demonic. It's just spiritual mismanagement. They haven't been forgiving people. They haven't been confessing their sins. They haven't been avoiding temptation. They haven't been honest. These are spiritual problems. These are not medical issues. And a lot, struggling with guilt. Lots of those things they're not demonic and they're not physical, but they are spiritual. And therefore, like I said, if I was dealing with an actual case rather than speaking in generalities as I am right now, I would want to explore with the person. What is it? Let's see what we can eliminate. You've had these medical tests, so it's not that, let's talk about these other issues. I believe that many people who are labeled as mentally ill don't have anything like a real illness, but they simply have bad habits, bad behavior. They're not managing their spiritual life well, and there are ways to do that. And the Bible certainly indicates that a lot of the problems that people go to see counselors about are problems that the Bible says God can take care of if you're, you know, frankly, if you're living for God and filled with the Spirit, walking in the Spirit and so forth. I realize not everyone who says a prayer, not everyone who quotes a Bible verse, not everyone who gets baptized and becomes a Christian automatically walks in the Spirit or has victory over these areas. I'm not naive, but I do know that even people who are not getting victory in those areas and who are Christians, in many cases, there are ways that they can get victory over them, which are not chemical means, and that are because sometimes their problems are not chemical, but spiritual. I can only speak generally in that way to you. If you want to talk to me, you know, personally, at some point, I mean, I don't advertise myself as a counselor or anything like that, but I'm a Christian brother, and I would, if you want to write to me or something like that, I could possibly say make a few observations from what you tell me, but I can't give specific counsel about something like this over the air. For example, if you're taking antidepressants, and if I said, you know, I suggest maybe you try not taking those. Well, then you stop taking them, and then you commit suicide. Someone sues me because I don't have a license to tell people to stop taking antidepressants. Well, I don't do that. I don't give people that kind of counsel. But I will say there can be alternatives to medications which can be explored, and which I think in many cases a person would be well off to do because their problem really lies elsewhere than in what they think. Let's talk to James from Temecula, California. James, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
I appreciate so much having the opportunity to be on the show today, and I appreciate everything the gentleman said. I had some questions concerning the mark of the beast, because it appears that every other book other than the book of Revelations, you know, is more history and strength, but when we look at this book, the Revelations, this was given to John by Jesus' angel. You know, this was a message directly for future purposes, you know, where we have some patterns that are like that leads even into heaven. But this pattern led...
Well, let me jump in here, because I'm going to agree with you in saying that Revelation is unlike other books of the Bible. That is, it is unlike most of the books of the Bible, because, as you say, most of the books of the Bible are historical narrative. That's true in the Old Testament and the New Testament. The majority of the material, at least, is historical narrative and not talking about the future. However, there are books besides Revelation in the Bible that do talk about the future, of course. There are prophetic books in the Old Testament, and a few of them are written in the same style that Revelation is. Like Daniel has visions very much like Revelation. Zechariah is another book that has visions very much like the book of Revelation. In fact, Revelation borrows imagery from both Daniel and Zechariah and other parts of the Old Testament. Now, I'll just say that if the book of Revelation were not available to us, at least not yet, and let's say we were familiar with Daniel and Zechariah, but we later became familiar with Revelation, I think what we would have to say is this. The book of Daniel talks in strange visions with strange symbols about beasts and things like that. And it's talking about things that were relevant in Daniel's day. It talks about the Babylonian Empire and how that the Media-Persian Empire would conquer it and how the Grecians would conquer them and so forth. Well, in Daniel's own day, Babylon was in power and the Media-Persian Empire conquered that and so forth. So in other words, they were talking about things that were relevant to some of the people living at that time, including Daniel himself. Likewise, in Zechariah, the visions of Zechariah are mostly about things that pertain to Zechariah's own day, have to do with God supporting Zerubbabel and Joshua in the temple building, and how that God was going to, you know, remove the difficulties, and he's going to, by his Spirit, help them overcome it. There's a lot of things in Zechariah, these visions that he had, that are relative to their own day. Now, each of these books, Daniel and Zechariah, also have a few things to say about things that were somewhat more distant future. But much of the visions, the strange visions in Zechariah and Daniel, are really not about the distant future at all. They're really just talking about the day in which these prophets were living and their readers were living. That's just that God was communicating something about their day in a strange mode, that is, through visions with strange images. And if you read Daniel or Zechariah, you'll see what I mean. Now, if we knew Daniel and Zechariah, and then we encountered the book of Revelation and knew nothing else about it, as we read the book of Revelation, we'd say, well, this is a lot like Daniel and Zechariah. It's got these visions, these strange beasts and things like that. And therefore, like Daniel and Zechariah, it probably is God's way of communicating some things to us that probably could be communicated in a different form, but he's choosing to use the same form he used in Daniel and Zechariah. God doesn't have to use these strange visions. He could just spell it out. He does in some other places. But these visions sometimes put into pictures the teachings and lessons that are given only in words in other places. But the fact that the visions are strange and that they do in some respects deal with future things doesn't mean that everything in the book is to be taken as futuristic, because I believe much of it had to do with the time of the readers to whom it was written.
You may need to do some more studying on this subject, because it's such a powerful subject, and the whole world is lining up for a cashless society starting in America. All you got to do is do your history and take a look at what's going on from the Federal Reserve Bank, but are privately owned,
well, James,
from the Rockefellers, from everything that's going on behind the scenes, and all of them hate Christians.
James, I've heard all that before, so I don't really have to look into it. I used to teach some of those things myself. The truth is, even if there will be a cashless society in the future, that doesn't tell us how the book of Revelation is to be interpreted. You see, one of the difficulties I have, the problems I have with modern Bible prophecy teachers, is that they follow a procedure I call newspaper exegesis. They say, well, this is in the newspaper, this is happening right now, and therefore that's what the Bible means when it talks about this. Well, I want to look at the passage in the Bible and say, is that what it means? Is that really the best way to understand what it means? Just because we find something in the newspaper that we think corresponds well with our interpretation of a certain passage, that doesn't settle the question as to whether the passage is talking about that or something else. I didn't say that there will not be a cashless society. There very well might be one. I don't make any predictions about the future. Maybe there will be, and maybe there won't be. I don't know. I wouldn't deny it. But what I'm saying is, I don't think the book of Revelation or any part of the Bible mentions a cashless society. That's a different thing than saying there won't ever be one.
There is no battery. So my point is, sir, when teaching the church in the book of Revelation, that's not like every other book. That book was given to the church by Jesus, and to say that that's not prophecy, I say, so you need to jump in that book a little bit more, my brother.
Well, maybe I will jump in a little more, but I happen to have read 50 commentaries on Revelation cover to cover, and I've taught through Revelation for 45 years cover to cover. I've taught verse by verse through Revelation at least 40 times. And I've written a book called Revelation 4 Views, where I summarize the teachings of 50 commentaries. So maybe I do need to look at Revelation a little more, but I already have looked at it a fair amount. I think enough to make some responsible comments about it. I appreciate your call, though. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. And tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless you. Thanks for joining us.